So this is the first of two lectures on optimal portfolio selection. Now the first slide in this lecture looks a little bit intimidating. Before we get into the mathematical formalism, let's understand the intuition. We've now got some understanding of the concept of risk. We recognize that in the real world, there is risk. Today, we have limited information about what's going to happen in the future. We've also come to recognize that individuals are typically risk-averse. So it won't surprise you when I say to you that individual investors are interested in ways of reducing risk. Now, up until now, we've been thinking about investing money in an individual asset. That could be shares in a particular listed company. That could be units in a bond that a company issues as a borrowing instrument, or possibly a bond issued on behalf of a sovereign government. So far, we've been thinking about investing money, some of our wealth, in an individual asset. But there was a clue for us in one of the questions in Seminar 1, namely the question that took us back to what we talked about briefly at the end of the very first lecture. Now, at the end of the first lecture, we looked at a simple example of how we would model risk. We had two asset classes. We had the possibility of investing in the shares of car manufacturing companies, and we had the possibility of investing in gold, a particular commodity. And in that example, the way that we modelled risk was to acknowledge we didn't know today what would happen next period, so we invented three distinct scenarios. Either the economy would end up in a recession, the economy would proceed as normal, or the economy would boom. Now, the seminar question asked you to finish off that example for yourself, and in the process, rehearse, or possibly learn for the first time, about some additional concepts, covariance and correlation. Having explained to you in the lecture about expected return and variance of returns on a single asset, the seminar question took you forward by introducing you to the idea of the covariance between the returns on two distinct assets, and likewise the correlation. If you worked through that problem, if you went to the seminar and watched the tutor work through it in front of you, you will have come to realize that those two particular assets behaved in a special way relative to one another. The numbers in that question were chosen so that those two assets were perfectly negatively correlated to one another. So in that particular problem, it is possible to divide up your wealth between the two investment classes, between shares in the car manufacturing stocks and gold, in such a way as to eliminate all of the risk. Now, that total elimination of risk is only possible in that example because the returns on the two assets are perfectly negatively correlated. In general, the correlation coefficient is going to be somewhere between minus 1 and plus 1. But what that example has suggested to us is that combining different assets in a portfolio is a way of reducing risk. And that's the theme that runs through this week's lectures. We're going to go in search of the best possible way of doing that. Given a set of assets that we can invest in, what is the optimal combination of those assets that minimizes our exposure to risk? So the theme underpinning this week's lectures is one of risk reduction by diversification. Diversification means spreading our wealth across a set of different investment classes, a set of different assets. So now we're ready to start to model this. So it's a little bit mathematical to begin with, but that shouldn't cause us too many problems. And there isn't any mathematics in this module that I didn't preview for those of you who are a little bit nervous with mathematics that I didn't preview in the maths and stats review class. So in general then, we have N assets to choose from. And we might choose to invest some of our money in each of those N assets, big N. So what we're doing is constructing a portfolio. Each asset has an expected return. Each asset has a variance of returns. And each pair of assets has a covariance between their returns. So that's what's listed here. And really what's going on in the top of this slide, as much as anything, is me introducing the notation to you. Now, those of you who were in the classes, the seminar classes that I taught on Thursday and Friday, will already have met this shorthand notation for variance, sigma squared. That's because I typically like to use sigma for standard deviation. So does most of the finance academic community. I'm not exactly being original here. So that's the setup. For each of these N assets, there's an expected return, there's a variance of return, and for each pair of assets that you can form, there is a covariance. And these are the standard definitions from statistics. Now, as you will learn when you attempt one of the seminar questions on portfolio theory, so that's not this week's seminars, that's next week's seminars, there's a question which is aimed at you convincing yourself that the return on a portfolio of assets is nothing more complicated than a weighted average of the individual returns. And the weights, and I label those weights W, the weights indicate the percentages or proportions of wealth, value if you like, that are invested in each of those N assets. So if you were to divide up your wealth equally across 10 assets, each of the portfolio weights would be 1/10. So the weights indicate how much of your wealth, how much in value terms, is invested in each of the individual assets in a given portfolio. Those weights, therefore, must add up to 100%, or if you express them in decimal form, they must add up to 1. And the seminar question that I'm previewing for you, the seminar in question invites you to convince yourself that the expected return on a portfolio is simply the weighted average of the individual expected returns. I'm not going to do that for you here and now. I want you to work through that for yourself. Another question in the seminar invites you to come up with the corresponding result for the variance of returns on the portfolio. Now, there's more than one way to do it, but I would suggest that the quickest way is to recognize that variance is simply covariance of something with itself. So the little trick is to remember that the variance of returns on a portfolio, P, is the same thing as the covariance between the returns on that portfolio with the returns on that portfolio. Then you fall back on the earlier result that I'm asking you in one of the seminar questions to convince yourself is true. You fall back on the earlier result that the return on a portfolio is simply the weighted average of the individual returns. So here I'm writing it for portfolio P. Here again I'm writing it for portfolio P. I've used up the symbol I as my summation index on the left-hand side, so I have to use something else, say J. And now I can expand. I can take the summations outside of this covariance. So what I end up with is a sum of terms. Each term has the same structure. It multiplies together two weights by the covariance between the returns on a particular pair of assets. So what's going on down here in this double summation is we are picking out pairs of assets, two at a time. For each pair of assets, there is a covariance between their returns, their individual returns, and each asset comes with a weight that says how much, in value terms, does that asset contribute to the portfolio. So we pick up the product of the two weights. Now, it looks a bit formal, but it isn't really. Let's have a look at the simplest case. Well, the simplest case I can think of is when I have only two assets to invest in. So that double summation that looked a little bit frightening isn't really so frightening after all. Because when there are only two assets, so big N is two, that double summation reduces to the following. I get a term in which W1 appears squared. I get a term in which W1 multiplies W2. I get another term in which W1 multiplies W2. And finally, I get a term in which W2 is squared. I can write this rather more neatly using matrices. And we talked a little bit about matrices in the maths and stats review class. So, when n is 2, and there's nothing particularly special about n is 2, it just means there's less for me to write. When n is 2, I see that the expression for the variance of returns on this portfolio of two assets, it's a sum of terms. Now let's be clear. Sigma 1, 1, that would be the covariance between the returns on asset 1 with the returns on asset 1. That's just the variance of returns on asset 1. Likewise, sigma 2,2 is the variance of returns on asset 2. So let me replace them in the diagonal entries of the matrix. Now, sigma 1,2, that's the covariance between the returns on asset 1 and the returns on asset 2. That's the same thing as the covariance between the returns on asset 2 with the returns on asset 1. So sigma 1,2 and sigma 2,1 are equal to one another. So I could, if I'd chosen, I could write that as sigma 1,2. So what have I got for my trouble? What I've got sitting in the middle of this matrix product, I've got a matrix with two rows and two columns. No surprise there, that's because I've got two assets. In the diagonal entries, here and here, I have the variance of returns on asset 1 and asset 2. And in the off-diagonal entries, I have the covariance between the returns on asset 1 and asset 2. And now, it isn't a huge leap of the imagination to see how this will generalise to the case of N assets. Just do the following in your mind. Grab hold of this bottom right-hand corner of this so-called variance-covariance matrix and start to pull it downwards and to the right. As you pull it downwards, additional rows and columns appear. There's a row and a column for each individual asset. So in general, if we're looking at portfolios of big N assets, we have a weight for each of those N assets. So this row vector now has big N entries from W1 all the way to WN. This column vector, likewise, has N entries from W1 all the way to WN. And sitting in the middle is an N by N symmetric square matrix, the so-called variance-covariance matrix. The matrix formalism gives you an easy way to remember the full expression for the variance of returns on the portfolio, which is what we've got down here. So, if we just go back for one moment then, just have one more look at that formula as soon as the visualizer comes up. We've got a variance term for asset 1, a variance term for asset 2, and we've picked up two terms, each of which involve the covariance between the returns on asset 1 and asset 2. And that's exactly what we've got here in the general case. In the general case where there are n assets, we've got n variance terms, one for each asset, and those variances get multiplied by the square of the individual weights. Everything else is a sum of covariances. And for each covariance, there is the product of the two relevant weights. Now ask yourself this. How many variance terms are there? Answer, n. How many covariance terms are there? Answer, n squared minus n. Because the double summation has in total n squared terms. N of them involve variances. So the remaining n squared minus n, or if you prefer, n times in brackets n minus 1, the remaining terms must all be covariances. Well, now we can start to put this to work for ourselves. Let's do so. But let's not get bogged down in detail. Let's make some assumptions that make the maths easier and that doesn't cover up any of the important intuition. So here's the assumption I'm going to make. Let's suppose each of these n assets has the same expected return. Let's call that common value mu, the Greek letter mu for the letter m. Why am I choosing that? Because it makes me think of mean. An expected value is another name for mean of a distribution. So let's assume that all n assets have the same expected return. Let's go further. Let's assume that all n assets have the same variance of returns, and let's call that common value v. And let's assume that the covariance between any pair of assets you might like to choose is also always the same, and we'll call that common value c. Now, if you don't like that, then you'll prefer what's written on the slide, because what's written on the slide is, let's think of mu, v, and c as average values. But I'm not fussed about that. I'm quite happy, for the time being, to simplify the problem to the following. I'm going to build portfolios out of n assets, and to keep the story as simple as possible, I'm assuming that each of the n assets has the same expected return, each of the n assets has the same variance of returns, and any pair of two assets has the same covariance of returns, little c. I'm going to make it even simpler. And it's in this sense that what I'm looking at on this slide is called naive diversification. Because I've wiped away any individual differences between the different assets, all I'm interested in for the moment is seeing what difference it makes to having several assets in my portfolio. So that's why I call this naive diversification. I'm not paying any particular attention to the individual risk-return properties of a given asset. How can I? Because I've decided to assume they're all the same in terms of their expected return, variance of return, and covariance between two returns. Well, I might as well go the final hog and say, let's just look at equally weighted portfolios. So I'll remind you, an equally weighted portfolio is a portfolio in which we are dividing up our wealth equally across the N assets. If this was a portfolio of shares in different companies, it doesn't mean we buy the same number of shares in each of those companies, because the share prices will be different. What it means is the amount of our money that we invest in total in the shares of one company is the same as we invest in the shares of any other company. That's what equally weighted means. Well, if there are big N assets to choose from and the portfolio is equally weighted, then the individual weights must be 1 over n. That just makes the maths a little bit easier. Expected return on this portfolio of n assets? Well, it has to be mu, since the individual expected returns are also equal to mu. But there's the formal proof. We need to think a bit harder about variance, and that's what we're interested in. So we're using the result at the foot of the previous slide. The variance of returns on a portfolio of n assets is the sum of n squared terms, n of which are variances, and n squared minus n of which are covariances. But every variance in this problem is now the same, it's little v, and every covariance between any pair of assets is always the same, it's little c. So let's look at the variance terms. There are n of them, one for each asset. The variance is always multiplied by the square of the weight, but the weights are always 1 over n. We have to square that, so that explains that factor. And the individual variances are v. So this first term on the right-hand side mops up very nicely for us the sum of the n variances. Now we've got to worry about the n squared minus n covariances. Well, n squared minus n is the same thing as n times, in brackets, n minus 1. Each of the covariance terms brings in the product of the two weights. But each of the weights is 1 over n. So the product of the two is, once again, 1 over n all squared. This time, what's multiplying all of this is the covariance. And that's always equal to little c in this setup. So now I can simplify like crazy. First to get this expression, and then finally to get the expression that's at the foot of the slide. You need to be able to reproduce this argument. I could ask you, as part of an exam question, to reproduce this argument. So what we're looking at here is naive diversification, where we don't pay attention to the individual risk-return properties of the individual assets. Instead, to keep things nice and simple, we assume they all have the same properties, and all we are exploring is, what is the impact of having more assets rather than fewer assets in the portfolio? In other words, how important is big N? Big N is the tuning parameter, if you like, here. We want to explore, how does the variance of returns on our portfolio vary with big N? We've set the individual variances to be little v. That number doesn't change. We've set the covariance between pairs of assets to be little c. That number doesn't change. The only number that we're interested in changing in naive diversification is big N. Remember, we're risk averse. We want to reduce risk. Risk is measured either by standard deviation of returns, or here it's more convenient to work with variance of returns. So the question we want to ask ourselves is, how is the level of risk associated with the portfolio, how is that affected as we change the value of big N? And I hope you can see what happens. Because the bigger is the value of N, keeping little v and little c fixed. In other words, the more and more assets you include in your portfolio, even though they've all individually got the same risk-return characteristics, the more and more assets you include in your portfolio, the lower is the overall level of risk associated with the portfolio. This is naive diversification at work. Let's look at a picture, because we can go further with the story. So, here's a graph where along the horizontal is the value big N, and up the vertical is the variance of returns on the portfolio. Now, the smallest number of assets I can have in my portfolio is 1. If I choose to put all of my eggs in one basket, as it were, if I choose to invest 100% of my wealth in one of these assets, then the variance of returns on my portfolio is little v. The result at the foot of the previous slide tells me the other end of the spectrum, where I decide to spread my wealth increasingly thinly over a larger and larger number of assets, i.e. I let N get bigger and bigger and bigger, the result at the foot of the previous slide tells me that the variance of returns on my portfolio gets closer and closer to little c. So the graph is capturing how we are able to reduce risk with naive diversification, i.e. simply taking more and more assets into the portfolio. The variance of returns falls from little v asymptotically down towards little c. Now, what's so interesting about that result? Well, the first point is that here I have a simple means of reducing risk. That's supposed to be red according to this screen. That's interesting. Ah, that's better. That's still black. Never mind. Now that's black again. That's interesting. Now it's red. Crazy. I think it depends how close I point with the pen to the curve. As we increase big N, as we take more and more assets into the portfolio, the overall level of risk, as measured by variance of returns, is dropping. But the graph is also telling us there's a limit to how much risk we can get rid of, we can eliminate. And that suggests that we should compartmentalize risk. We should partition it into two components. There appears to be a component whose value, if measured by variance of returns, is little c. There appears to be a component that we cannot reduce by diversification. That's known as systematic risk. It's also known as market risk, or, not terribly imaginative name, non-diversifiable risk. Three different names for the same thing. So the graph isn't just telling us that we can reduce risk by spreading our wealth more and more thinly. The graph is also telling us there is a limit to how much risk we can eliminate. The graph does not go all the way down to zero. There is a floor below which we cannot go, and the height of that floor is controlled by the value of little c. So little c is capturing something about this overall economy made up out of these assets. It's something to do with the degree to which these assets behave in the same way. After all, that's what covariance is measuring. Covariance between returns on individual pairs of assets. Depending on the value of little c, that determines how much risk we can eliminate. The other component of risk we can, in principle, get completely rid of. And that's known as specific risk, or idiosyncratic risk, or, again, not very imaginative name, diversifiable risk. So what the graph is actually telling us is the way in which to get rid of some of the risk with naive diversification is to spread our wealth more thinly. In other words, take more assets into our portfolio. But the graph is also telling us there's a limit to how far we can eliminate that risk, and what controls that limit is the covariance between pairs of assets. So that's our first hint, that covariance is the key variable. That's going to continue to be true as we go further with the story this week and indeed next week. So keep that in mind. If you prefer to think in terms of correlation, you should be able to write down a relationship between covariance C and variance V. Convince yourself that the covariance C is given by the product, I'll call it rho, the Greek letter for R, rho, correlation coefficient, times V. Convince yourself that C equals rho times V. You just have to remind yourself, what is covariance? Covariance is the product of correlation coefficient and the individual standard deviations. Well, the standard deviation of returns on any asset in this world is the square root of V. So you've got little rho, the correlation coefficient, multiplying the square root of V for the first asset, multiplying the square root of V for the second asset. Square root of V times itself makes V. So little c equals rho, the correlation coefficient, times V. You might want to write that down somewhere on the slide. That could be useful to remember that. There's a question on the seminar for next week that uses real data. And what the question in the seminar asks you to think about is, so, if you were to put together a portfolio made up out of the shares of different listed companies, so we call that an equity portfolio, how far could you reduce the risk of that portfolio by taking more and more such equities into the portfolio? And would it matter if you were doing this using only UK equities, or using only US equities, or using only French equities or German equities or whatever? What about if you allowed yourself to choose shares of companies listed on different stock markets? So an international portfolio that draws on the traded equities in the UK, in the US, blah, 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 blah. What can you learn? How far can you push risk reduction? So there's a question in the seminar that takes that as its setting and asks you to do a little bit of thinking. Some of the results are summarised on this slide. I'll leave you to read that in your own time. The real message then, and the bottom bullet point hints at this, if I go back to the graph, the real message behind all of this is the following. Nobody is seriously suggesting you should limit yourself to naive diversification. What is the point? You're coming here twice a week to study finance if all you're going to do as far as diversification is concerned is naive diversification. That seems to me to be using a sledgehammer to crack a walnut. So there must be something else that we should learn from this slide that has the graph. And here's what it is. In the real world, we don't just decide how many assets to take in our portfolio if we want to reduce risk. We also have to do some thinking about which assets to include in the portfolio. Because in the real world, of course, the assets don't all very conveniently have the same expected return, the same variance of returns, and any pair of assets doesn't conveniently have the same covariance. So the other message coming out of this slide and this graph is we should think long and hard about which assets to combine in our portfolio, and we should be guided by the covariance between the returns on individual pairs, or, as it turns out to be more convenient, the correlation coefficient. So when it comes to the business in reality of building, say, an equity portfolio, then what we're going to be guided by in our choice of assets is the correlation coefficient between pairs of assets. This diagram is suggesting to us that the lower is the correlation coefficient, the greater is the scope for risk reduction. Remember what I said a few minutes ago, that little c equals the product of the correlation coefficient rho times v. If we take the trouble to pick assets whose returns are not very strongly correlated with one another, then the more scope there is for reducing risk by forming the portfolio. The extreme example we saw in last week's seminars of combining in a portfolio only two assets, shares in car manufacturing stocks and gold, in that extreme example where the correlation coefficient was exactly -1, we were able to completely eliminate risk. In general, we'll have to make do with reducing risk. But the real message here for us as potential portfolio managers wanting to do something either with our own money or a client's money, the real message is give thought to your choice of individual assets. Choose assets for which the degree of correlation is low. Now, generally, if you're choosing from the world of equities, if you're picking a UK equity portfolio or a US equity portfolio, generally the correlation coefficients between pairs of equities are positive. So we can't get into the extreme example that we had in last week's seminar where the correlation coefficient is -1. But what we can do is select individual stocks which have a low correlation coefficient with some other stock. We can combine them and try to exploit the low correlation coefficient. So that's a learning point to remember for the future. When we start to do that, we are getting into what we really should be getting into, which is what I call efficient diversification. Because efficient diversification isn't treating all assets as if they were perfect substitutes for one another and simply deciding how many of them to take in our portfolio. Efficient diversification is looking at the individual risk return properties and indeed the covariance or correlation properties between pairs of assets. Now again, I want to give you a sneak preview of what's coming. So I want to draw a cartoon that I hope will help you in the lectures ahead. This is something to refer back to. So there's no suggestion that you should know where has this graph, this diagram come from. We're not there yet. But this is just to look ahead to set our compass, if you like. So now I'm labelling my axes. Along the horizontal is standard deviation of returns. and up the vertical is expected return. Now let me remind you of what we're like as investors. We're rational and we're risk averse. Rational means we prefer more wealth to less wealth. We prefer higher rates of return to lower rates of return. So the fact that we're rational means that we are happier, all other things being equal, the higher up we sit in this diagram. But we're also risk averse. We don't like exposure to risk. So all other things being equal, we are happier the further to the left we sit. It turns out that there's a limit to how far we can combine these two desires. Ideally, we would like to sit up in the top left-hand corner. The further we can position ourselves in a northwesterly direction, the happier we'll be. But the theory that we're going to move on to tells us that there's a limit to what we can do. And that limit is described by a curve. Now, choosing the axes as I've done, it turns out that curve is a hyperbola. Not that you need to know why that is, or indeed what a hyperbola is. What I do want you to know is that when we're combining any number, big N, of assets to make a portfolio, there's a trade-off involved. We would like to maximise our expected return and at the same time minimise our standard deviation of returns, or if you prefer, our variance of returns. It is not possible to go all the way with both. So, in particular, if we wish to achieve that level of expected return, what we will learn is there are any number of portfolios, combinations of the N assets that we can form, that the standard deviation of returns on those portfolios, and therefore the level of risk, can be reduced. That's taking me in and towards the left, but there is a limit to how far we can go. For that value of expected return, it will turn out that this point on this graph, and this graph is given a name, and again, finance is not very imaginative. What we're doing here in drawing this graph is collecting together all of the portfolios which have the lowest level of risk for a given level of expected return. And we call this the minimum variance frontier. So we'll meet this in time. We'll come across this idea of there being a minimum variance frontier. And the idea is, for a given value of expected return, so someone who insists on a higher level of expected return, that investor has to put up with, has to tolerate a higher level of risk. If you wish to go higher up in the diagram, in general, you've got to be happy, prepared to sit further to the right. So what this graph, what this curve represents is the set of minimum variance portfolios. There is one for each possible value of expected return. And we would like to know, how can we find these minimum variance portfolios? So, that's just something by way of preview for the story that we're going to come to. And that's just summarised in words on this slide. So now we're ready to do some more work. Again, let's not get carried away with ourselves. The simplest scenario then is when we have only two assets to choose from. So let's fall back on the case of big N equals two. Two risky assets. So each of these two assets has not just an expected return, but also a standard deviation of returns, or if you prefer, a variance of returns, and, most importantly, a covariance between their returns, or if you prefer, a correlation coefficient. That correlation coefficient is going to play a key role. So, in this setup, we want to look at combinations of two particular assets. So maybe you should write down that I am assuming asset A and asset B have been selected. They're not changing. So we've decided on A and B. The question we want to explore in the next few slides is, what combination of A and B should we take? And what decides that for us? What property or properties about either A or B individually, or A and B looked at together, what property or properties decides for us what is the best combination? So A and B are fixed. We're forming portfolios out of those two assets alone. So whatever we don't invest in asset A, we automatically invest in asset B. So the two weights, again, must sum to one. Or if you prefer them in percentage terms, must add up to 100%. Remember the general result that I mentioned earlier in the lecture, in which I said a seminar question next week invites you to convince yourself is true. The expected rate of return on a portfolio is the weighted average of the individual expected returns. Remember the general expression for the variance of returns on a portfolio. There were variance terms and covariance terms. We've got two assets, so we pick up a variance term for asset A. That variance is multiplied by the square of the weight on asset A. We pick up a variance term for asset B. That variance term is multiplied by the square of the weight of asset B in the portfolio. The other two terms, and they're equal to one another, hence the factor of two, the other two terms bring in the covariance between the returns of on asset A and on asset B, and that covariance is multiplied by the product of the two weights. You might want to write on the slide, you might want to write for this expression, sigma AB. It's the same thing. It's just more useful for my purposes to write things in terms of correlation coefficient. So this whole expression is the same thing as the covariance between the returns on A and B. This correlation coefficient is going to play the key role. So let's start with the simplest possible case, where the correlation coefficient is plus one. So returns on the two assets are perfectly positively correlated. And let's look more closely at the expression for the variance of returns on that portfolio. The only thing that's changed from the equation that was at the foot of the previous slide is I've substituted the value of plus one for the correlation coefficient, so it's sitting in there as a plus one. This whole expression is a perfect square. So let me write it as such. And now let me do the obvious step, which is take the square root of either side. Let's get rid of the squares so we have an expression for the standard deviation. In general, the expected return on the portfolio is a weighted average of the individual expected returns. It's a nice linear expression. In general, the variance of returns is a non-linear expression. Likewise, the standard deviation. But in this special case, the standard deviation of returns on the portfolio is, just like the expected return on the portfolio, a nice linear combination of the individual standard deviations. That's very pleasing mathematically. It makes it incredibly boring from the point of view of finance. Because what that's telling us is there is no scope whatsoever for getting rid of any risk here. Any reduction in risk that we achieve is at the expense of a proportionate reduction in expected return. No use. So if there's one thing we will not do, if we're interested in reducing risk by diversification, we will not pair up assets that are perfectly positively correlated with one another. It's no damn use. This graph shows you why. There's a little bit of algebra that I've done on the slide, which you can reproduce for yourself. The key message is in the graph. The graph represents the set of possible combinations of these two assets, which are perfectly positively correlated with one another. And the graph is a really boring straight line that increases from left to right. If we want to reduce the risk of our portfolio, the only way we can do it in this situation is by giving up a proportionate amount of expected return. If we want to move to the left in the diagram, we have to come down step by step. So there's no scope for risk reduction by diversification here. So let's move on. Let's look at the opposite extreme, because the seminar question from last week, where indeed there were two asset classes that were perfectly negatively correlated with one another, suggested we could be in business. So now we flip our attention to the other extreme. Go back to the expression for the variance of returns on the portfolio of two assets. Now I substitute minus one for the correlation coefficient, hence a negative sign appears. Again, I've got a perfect square. I just have to be a little bit more careful now when I get rid of the squares on both sides. There's a plus root and a minus root that I need to worry about. So there are two solutions here. Again, you can go through the algebra yourself. What matters to me is what does the graph end up looking like? Now it's much more interesting. If I were to invest all of my wealth in asset A alone, I would sit here. If I were to invest all of my wealth in asset B, I would sit up here. If I invest some of my wealth in asset A, with the remainder in asset B, I sit somewhere on one of these two line segments. So let's start with the situation in which all of my wealth is invested in asset A. Now I sell some of my investment in A, and with the proceeds I realise I spend it, I invest the proceeds in B. As I start to reduce the weight of investment in A, and I start to introduce B into my portfolio, I start to move along this straight line segment. If I carry on with that, I then start to track up this straight line segment until I reach this point where now I have no unit. I have nothing of asset A in my portfolio. I'm entirely invested in asset B. What makes this case interesting? Two reasons. One, here is a way of reducing risk. I'm moving to the left. But at the same time, I'm increasing expected return. I like the sound of that. But I like the sound of something else even more. Because if I continue with this substitution effect, where I'm gradually replacing more and more of A with units of B, not only am I reducing risk and at the same time increasing expected return, but there is one particular combination where risk completely vanishes. I have completely eliminated risk. My portfolio no longer has any risk. My portfolio, at this point, is the risk-free asset. So the expected return on that portfolio will be the risk-free rate. How do I find that so-called perfect hedge portfolio? Well, a little bit of algebra gets me the answer. I want the standard deviation, or variance if you prefer, I want the standard deviation of returns on my portfolio to be zero. I've got an expression for the standard deviation of returns on my portfolio. Here it's here. Plus or minus. I just choose the correct one. It doesn't really matter which of the two I use. Set that expression equal to zero. Wait a minute. Where is the weight of B disappeared? I've used the fact that the two weights must add up to one. So the weight of A plus the weight of B must always equal one. So I can substitute for the weight of B the expression 1 minus the weight of A, and tidy the expression up. Here are the weights for that particular portfolio that has zero risk. What you could do for yourself now is go back to the seminar question involving shares of car manufacturing stocks and gold. You've calculated the standard deviation of returns on each of those two asset classes. So now you could determine for yourself, in what proportions should you invest in car manufacturing stocks and gold to completely eliminate risk in that problem? I'll tell you more on Wednesday.